From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, One Day in Dallas, the Death of a President. Produced by KUT, Austin Public Media.
It was one of those days when the silver of the jet's fuselage had turned robin's egg blue, reflecting the color of a suddenly cloudless sky. They called it Kennedy weather. The grainy black and white images we've all seen before on television of a smiling president and first lady disembarking Air Force One at Love Field are in fact misleading. It's as if we almost can't help but glimpse the inevitability and feel helpless. For 50 years, we've been coming to terms with the fact that if we can't stop the awful moment from happening, perhaps at least we'll get to say goodbye somehow. But it's fair to face up to this reality. We've lost the true colors of the moment, the little details that made up that day in Dallas when America transitioned from one era to another. What we do remember, those of us who can remember, is where we were when we heard the news. Sid Davis remembers because he was there, in the motorcade, as the White House bureau chief for the Westinghouse radio stations. Davis had been assigned to accompany the president to cover the Dallas visit.
The bus I was on was press bus number one. The presidential limousine was about 8 car lengths ahead of the bus.
Also in the motorcade, the press aide for Texas Governor John Connally. His name is Julian Reed.
We had just come down Main Street, part of the motorcade, of course, from Love Field. We had thousands and thousands of people hanging out of skyscrapers to get a glimpse of the president and first lady. The street was jammed 6 or 7 deep on either side of the limousine. Ms. Connally, she had just turned to the president and said, "Mr. President, you certainly can't say Dallas doesn't love you."
From the studios of KUT Austin, I'm David Brown, and you're listening to One Day in Dallas, reflections on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy by two who were there.
And the crowd at our point is surging forward. There's a big cheer going up as the president gets further down. And now the ticker tape. And here is the President of the United States. And what a crowd, what a tremendous welcome he's getting now. We can, and there's Jackie. She's getting just as big a welcome. And the crowd is absolutely going wild. This is a friendly crowd in downtown Dallas as the president and the first lady pass by. There is Lyndon Johnson.
Before the afternoon of November 22, 1963, 50 years ago, neither Sid Davis nor Julian Reed could have expected what they'd be called upon to do, much less that they'd both be eyewitnesses to history. They came from different worlds. Davis was a young radio reporter based in Washington. Reed was on the other side of the journalistic fence, serving as a press aide for the top official in Texas. Governor Connally and his wife were the de facto hosts for the president and the first lady on that day, as the motorcade wound its way toward the Dallas Trade Mart for a luncheon. The Connallys sat just ahead of the Kennedys in the presidential limousine. Davis and Reed were in the press buses, just a few car lengths back.
There was a kind of an air of light, happy banter because it was such a surprise. There had been so much speculation, a lot of it by the press, of what sort of reaction he would get in Dallas, and it was just the opposite.
Julian Reed.
And then, of course, we made the turn onto Houston Street, and we were about the 8th unit in the motorcade, and about halfway in that block, I had a view directly down on the limousine because they had already made the turn. And I happened to have that view just by sitting where I was in the bus. And all of a sudden, pop, pop, pop.
Most people heard 3 shots.
Sid Davis.
I was sitting next to a friend named Bob Pierpoint of CBS News. Bob had served in Korea. He covered the Korean War. And he was pretty expert on gunfire. And that's the first thing he yelled to all of us. He said, "That's gunfire." Now, there were no Secret Service agents riding on the president's car, as is sometimes normal. Kennedy gave instructions to the Secret Service not to ride on the sides of his car. And his point was, "This is how I get elected." And he laughed about it. having people see Jackie, he felt was a great political benefit. The crowds started to disperse, and people started running in different directions. And as you approached Dealey Plaza, the so-called grassy knoll, you saw parents jumping on top of their kids to shield them. Women were trying to peel off their shoes or their heels so they could run faster in the grass. By that time, the limousine had just took off. And the follow-up car, which is a great big heavy Cadillac, which follows immediately behind the president's car, took off behind it.
This is an NBC News bulletin. Shots were fired near President Kennedy in Dallas. Here is a report from Robert McNeil, NBC News, with the presidential party in Dallas.
Several shots were fired as President Kennedy's motorcade passed through downtown Dallas. Crowds screamed and lay down on the grass as the motorcade went by. Police broke away and began chasing an unknown gunman across some railroad tracks. It was not known if the shots were aimed at the president. Repeat, it is not known if the shots were aimed at the president. This is Robert McNeil, NBC News in Dallas, Texas.
Obviously, my concern was, where are they going now?
Connolly Press Aide Julian Reed.
One thing people forget today in telling this story, there were no cell phones. We had no communication. The only ones who had communications were the three in the pool car who had, two of them had radio phones, I believe, Sid, isn't that right?
One telephone.
One radio telephone. Otherwise, we were out of communications. That seems impossible today, but that was the case. I had to make a decision. I was one of two on the bus that were kind of making decisions what to do with it. I was a host for Governor Connolly. That's happened to be on the bus. Because he was the host, you know, for Texas for that trip. So I had to decide, what do we do with this bus? And we thought the best thing to do is go straight on to the trademark, where we knew there were thousands of people waiting for us.
To the trademark. At this time, the announcement has not been made to the several thousand who are here in the trademark as to what has happened. Details are still sketchy. The only thing that we have at this time is the report that the president is at Parkland Hospital, that Governor John Connolly was also wounded, and that a Secret Service agent was killed. According to the best reports that we have at this time, there were only three shots fired, and apparently all of them struck true.
We went directly to the trademark. They didn't know what had happened. They had no clue. And I jumped out of the bus. Literally jumped out of the bus. All the newsmen jumped out and ran to the payphones that lined the hall. Again, something from that era. Everybody had phones. All these public buildings had rows of payphones. So all the journalists rushed to the payphones. And I rushed up to Mr. Eric Johnson, who later became the mayor of Dallas. But he was the dinner chairman, the lunch chairman. And, of course, I will never forget going into that room and hearing the murmurs of 3,000 people. Anticipating the president, first lady to walk in any moment. And they didn't have a clue of what had occurred. So I ran up to him, and he was up on the podium. And I said, Mr. Johnson, we don't know what's happened, but we're afraid that the president and Governor Connolly have been shot. He was up above me. He just looked down at me and stared for a moment.
Coming before too long. Now, here is an announcement from the podium. Making the announcement will be J. Eric Johnson, the president of the Dallas Citizens Council, one of the sponsoring groups. Here is Mr. Johnson.
I'm not sure that I can say what I have to say. I feel a little bit like Southern Pearl Harbor does. It is true that our president, Governor Connolly, the motorcade happened shut. We do not know how seriously our reports are scant. They are difficult to get. We shall tell you as much as we know, as soon as we know anything.
That was the president of the Dallas Citizens Council, the audience comprised of many civic and business leaders here are, of course, stunned by the announcement that was made a moment ago by Mr. Johnson.
And then he called for a prayer.
And I rushed out and commandeered a car from a friend coming to the luncheon and raced over to Parkland Hospital to look for the Connollys. I was very concerned about them, of course. We kept pushing the bus driver to chase after the car, which was impossible. No way it would catch a limousine. The bus took us to the Trademark, where the speech was still going to take place, and we offloaded that bus in like 5 seconds, charging for telephones through the hall, and people were, I think there were about 2,000 people in there waiting to have lunch, and they had no idea what happened out on the streets. And they kept looking at us, and we couldn't say anything, and there was this press room on the second floor. I got to a phone, talked to my office, and I filed a story saying I was in the motorcade, heard the shots, but I couldn't say any more than that. And I got outside, I waved down a car with my Olivetti typewriter, and a wonderful guy stopped and with a white Cadillac, and he said, are you a reporter? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'll get you to the hospital. And we took off for the hospital. As I got to the hospital, the presidential limousine was sitting outside the emergency room. And Clint Hill had just, Mrs. Kennedy's agent, had just finished cleaning it up, straightening it out, because there was a mess on the back seat. And I remember seeing Hugh Seide, a very good friend from Time Magazine, standing there. And I went over to take a look inside to see what Clint Hill was working on. And Seide said, it's too horrible. Don't even bother looking. Mrs. Kennedy, by then, was with the stretcher, and she was helping pull the stretcher inside the emergency room, just moving as fast as she could to try to express some urgency to the situation to get him into treatment. And there were a herd of corpsmen around getting him inside. Then I tried to go inside following them, and they threw me out. And I went upstairs to the second floor, and I commandeered a phone and a nurse, or a nurse's aide, who held the phone for me while I ran back and forth picking up information, and they held the line open to Washington for me.
But you saw the president's body on the gurney?
I saw a white form on a stretcher. As I got there, I saw the white form on the stretcher. It had just been raised out of the car, and Mrs. Kennedy was at the head of it, and she was trying to pull it. She was trying to get it inside the hospital. She was desperate to get that stretcher inside the hospital.
Mr. Reed, had you been able to make any sort of contact with Governor Connolly or his wife?
Well, when I found her, I ran in the side door of the hospital. I remember vividly how much I was surprised to see nobody at all in sight. The end door of the Parkland Hospital was unattended. I just walked in the end door. And then I went to find a nurse. I found one very quickly and asked her to take me to Ms. Connolly. She took me to Ms. Connolly. Ms. Connolly and Mrs. Kennedy were sitting outside in Trauma Room 1 and Trauma Room 2, both their husbands fighting for their lives inside. Someone had placed two straight back chairs in the hallway. Neither of them spoke a word. I went to Ms. Connolly and I told her, of course she was very calm even though what had happened. Governor Connolly was already undergoing surgery inside the trauma room two. The president was in trauma room one, he was in trauma room two. She quickly told me what had happened in the limousine. I wanted to know what had happened because I wanted to be able to talk to the press. I knew that Malcolm Kilduff would be speaking on behalf of the president, but I wanted to be able to tell what happened in that limousine. So we very quickly, she constructed for me, I just took out a piece of paper and did a little sketch of what the seating arrangement was inside the limousine. And then I left her. I went to find Malcolm Kilduff, and we together set up quickly a temporary press room in the nurse's training room. And then shortly after that, all the reporters arrived and started gathering.
White House radio correspondent Sid Davis.
When I went to the second floor of Parkland Hospital after seeing Mrs. Kennedy take the stretcher inside down below and commandeered a phone, and a lovely nurse's aide held the phone for me. She was wonderful. I regret to this day I never got her name so I could write her a letter and say how wonderful she was. She held the phone open for me. Phones were at a premium. I'm sure you know how tough that was to get the phone. It was chaos in the hospital. I did the best I could with my story, but I was very careful too. As I was on the phone broadcasting what I had seen and waiting for the announcement, any time now they said we're going to have an announcement from Malcolm Kilduff on the president's condition. I noticed some of my friends were talking to two priests about 10 feet from me. And I was on the air live describing everything that I could possibly talk about. And I said to my boss, I just see two priests down there talking to Jerry Terhorst of the Detroit News, for instance. I said, I'm going to find out. I could, hold on, I'll find out what they're saying down there. What do they know? By that time, we didn't know the condition of John F. Kennedy. So I ran down there just as this priest said, he's dead all right. I just gave him the last rites. I told Mrs. Kennedy, he said, that I don't believe his soul had left his body. I remember those distinct words. Ran back to my phone, and I talked to this wonderful boss that I had. We were very close friends. He brought me to Washington, and I said, Jim, I want to talk to you, but I don't want to talk to you on the air. And he cut me off the air, and I said, Jim, there's a priest here who says the president's dead. He said he's given him the last rites. What do you want to do? And he said something like, well, what do you want to do? And we both agreed simultaneously that the story was too important. I might have said something like, I know a priest knows what a dead man looks like. But I said, Jim, and he agreed with me. He said, yeah, let's hold it.
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom, and there has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition. At Dallas, in the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. Let's switch down there now, where Eddie Barker of KRLD is on the air.
As you can imagine, there are many stories that are coming in now as to the actual condition of the president. One is that he is dead. This cannot be confirmed. Another is that Governor Connally is in the operating room. This we have not confirmed. The president was whisked from the scene of the attempted assassination, or assassination, depending upon his condition, of course, at this hour, by bus to Parkland Hospital. And the president undoubtedly is in the emergency room at that hospital, which would be on the first floor of Parkland. No word as yet. We are awaiting something more official. It is, of course, difficult, certainly, to go on scanty reports.
This is Walter Cronkite back at the CBS newsroom in New York. We have just been advised from Dallas that blood transfusions are being given to President Kennedy.
So we did not put that on the air. But, you know, your heart's pounding, and you don't even want to stop to say in your own mind, Kennedy's dead. So we held the story, and then about a minute or two later, Malcolm Kilduff came walking down the hall. He was the White House assistant press secretary at the time. Came walking by, and he shouted, there's a nurse's room. We're going to go into a nurse's room. We went in the nurse's training room. He went in there, and he opened up with everybody. His cheeks were streaked with tears. He could barely get the words out of his mouth.
John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas. He died of a gunshot wound in the brain. I have no other details regarding the assassination of the president.
Anything about the shooting? The impact of having the president lost, it was just hard for us to believe that he was dead. Your emotions have to be suppressed.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
I'm Julian Reed, R-E-A-D, aide to Governor Connally.
At Parkland Hospital, Julian Reed relayed the story recounted to him by Governor Connally's wife, a first-hand account of who was where in the presidential limousine when the shots were fired.
The president was seated in the right rear seat. Opposite in the left rear was Mrs. Kennedy. Immediately ahead of the president on a jump seat.
With the world now learning of Kennedy's assassination, a new concern arose, fueled by Cold War fears and the prospect that the U.S. was suddenly vulnerable, without a commander-in-chief. White House correspondent Sid Davis says he went looking for Malcolm Kilduff, the young press aide who issued the official announcement of Kennedy's death. Davis says Kilduff was in a secret room at Parkland with the vice president.
Johnson was being held incognito in one of the treatment rooms with Mrs. Johnson. Mrs. Johnson was sitting on a stool, and Kilduff, the way he described it to me many times, he said, I walked in there and I saw Mrs. Johnson sitting down. I looked at Lyndon Johnson, and I always thought of Lyndon Johnson as a vice president. I never thought of him as president. And he said, I looked at him and I didn't know what to say, and I said, Mr. President. And he said, Johnson was stunned. Kilduff thinks he was the first one to address Johnson as Mr. President. What do you want me to do? Johnson said, look, Mac, we don't know whether this is a communist conspiracy or not. And Mac says he did mention the word communist. I don't know whether this is a communist conspiracy or not, but you got to give me time to get out of here.
With that, Lyndon Johnson, Lady Bird, Jacqueline Kennedy, and several Kennedy aides were whisked away from Parkland under heavy cover. Reporter Sid Davis was swept up into the entourage en route to Love Field to be the eyes and ears of a nation, one of the few reporters on Air Force One witnessing the official transition of power.
The transfer of power was exemplary on part of Lyndon Johnson in that on Air Force One, his compassion for Mrs. Kennedy, the foresight he had to have his secretary, Marie Famer, in this cabin. We knew that Mrs. Kennedy was in terrible, terrible grief. She had all her wits about her. She knew what was going on. But Lyndon turned to Marie Famer, his secretary. I was standing right beside her, and Lyndon said, would you please go ask Mrs. Kennedy if she would like to stand with us for the swearing-in? There's going to be a picture taken. Lyndon Johnson knew the meaning of pictures. And Marie went back and talked to Mrs. Kennedy, and I thought to myself at that instant, you know, that would really be something if she leaves the casket, because she stayed with the casket all the way out from the hospital. She wouldn't leave it. And Mrs. Kennedy sent word in a few minutes, I would like to attend the ceremony, but I need a little time to clean myself up and compose myself. And we waited a few minutes, and she did come forward. She left the casket. The door opened to the compartment. President Johnson went over to her and took her by both hands and walked her to the center of the room and placed her to his left. He placed Mrs. Johnson to his right. When Mrs. Kennedy walked into the room, seeing her in that condition, her beautiful raspberry colored dress was speckled with flesh from her husband's head wound. There was blood on her wrist, her right hand, and on her skirt, and it had congealed on her stockings. I was a pool reporter, so I was writing furiously, hoping that I'd get everything. Otherwise, I was going to be in trouble. So I got whatever I could in my notes, and I transcribed it the way I actually saw it. It was a scene that you never expect to see, but she was a very brave, courageous lady. And the fact that she did what she did, the patriotism that she showed in coming up there to show there was unity in this country. Her husband was shot to death, and she was there with the new president. And I think the genius of Lyndon Johnson was to show this picture of the transitional role in America. The Constitution still lives. The Constitution works. And it showed the world that the United States was not imperiled here. And that picture tells millions of words about who we are as a people.
I do solemnly swear.
I do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve.
Preserve.
Protect.
Protect.
Defend. Constitution of the United States.
Constitution of the United States.
Help me, God.
So help me, God.
And Lyndon Johnson was so presidential. He was calm throughout. He knew what he had to do. He made the right phone calls to members of Congress. He saw to it that the Kennedy family was taken care of. He assured the Kennedy staff that they would have jobs. He called Mrs. Kennedy, Rose Kennedy, the president's mother, to offer his condolences, and immediately started making phone calls from Air Force One to members of Congress to set the balls rolling for the next few meetings, the next few days, to get the country organized. So I think it was Lyndon Johnson's finest hour. The Associated Press, which is a very neutral news service, it was then, it still is, said it was like a giant hand had reached down and soothed the heart of a grieving nation.
Davis, the White House correspondent for the Westinghouse radio stations on that day in Dallas, flew back to Washington with the newly sworn-in president and continued to report throughout the night, retaining his professional objectivity and composure until about 4 the next morning. Recounting JFK's love for Robert Frost, Davis tried to pay tribute by reciting the final lines from Frost's Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. The enormity of the tragedy finally became overwhelming.
One of the president's favorite quotations, and I believe it went something like this: I have promises to keep and many miles to go before I sleep. And with that, this is Sid Davis reporting from the White House.
In the 50 years that followed, Sid Davis would continue reporting from the White House, covering 9 presidents and serving as Washington bureau chief for NBC News. Connolly press aide Julian Reed, the man who offered the world the first detailed account of what happened that day in the presidential limousine, remained close to the Connollys over the years and became a nationally prominent corporate communications consultant. After 50 years of silence, Reed opens up about his experience in the new book, JFK's Final Hour in Texas. Our fascination with those final hours has never really been sated, perhaps because it's so difficult to come to terms with the prospect of a single event having such a profound impact on so many people all at once. Even today, it seems unimaginable that in the span of moments, a nation lost a president, another took control, an era came to an end, and another arose, staggering from tragedy, tears, and confusion. An era that largely defines who we are today, how we see the world, and how we understand our place in it. 50 years later, we are still struggling to fathom the full meaning of that one day in Dallas. From the studios of KUT Public Media, I'm David Brown.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. A special thanks to KUT for allowing us to distribute their radio documentary about the death of President John F. Kennedy. There's more information on their website, kut.org. You can write to Texas Matters with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. And we're on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.